Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. And as of today, I've been doing it for 6 years, so happy anniversary to the show, I guess, and thank you so much to anyone who's been listening from the first or even the most recent episode. It's great to have you on board. My guest this week is Anthony Scott Burns, a writer, director, composer, and cinematographer whose filmography includes the Father's Day segment of the Holidays horror anthology, the eerie short films Manifold and Lost Boy, and his feature debut, Our House, a reworking of the 90s thriller Ghost in the Machine. His latest film, Come True, is entirely its own thing, an uneasy, unsettling work of horror starring Julia Sarah Stone as a teenager whose participation in a sleep study turns her life into a waking nightmare. It's just arrived on VOD, and you should check it out. Anthony picked Manhunter, Michael Mann's 1986 adaptation of Thomas Harris's novel Red Dragon, the book that made literature out of the modern serial killer procedural and also introduced the world to that Hannibal Lecter guy. But Manhunter is not a Lecter movie. As in the book, he's just a supporting player in the drama of FBI profiler Will Graham, played by William Peterson, and Graham's latest target, serial killer Francis Dollarhide, played by Tom Noonan. Really, they're hunting each other, which is what made Red Dragon perfect material for a Michael Mann picture. We just didn't know it at the time. This is someone else's movie.
I first saw Manhunter when I was in a very difficult period of my life. I like to call it my Brian Wilson. I was undiagnosed Asperger's for many years of my life. Up until I was in my 30s, I didn't know what was going on with me. But there was a period when I was working retail. I worked a lot of really undesirable jobs growing up. And there was this period where I started to notice, you know, thanks to Mary Harron and American Psycho, the parallels between that movie and how I felt about what I would call toxic masculinity. Okay. And I grew up in a community where everyone manned up, and I was expected to do trades work if I wanted to exist. And it just wasn't me. My dad actually recently dredged up all my report cards, and they're pretty much across the board, failure, 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 art 100%. And that really doesn't do much for you when you're growing up in a sort of blue collar environment, especially in your teens. Yeah. And so I had this Brian Wilson year where I just sort of retreated and didn't leave my apartment very often. And I didn't have a lot of money. And one day I think I pawned off something in a pawn shop, and I saw this cover, Manhunter, a VHS. And I just went, how much for this? You know, it was like $3. And I took it home and I watched it, and because I was bored and I didn't know a lot about it. And I didn't know a lot about Michael Mann, to be honest, because, you know, outside of Heat, he hadn't made a lot of movies in the 90s. I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean,
just wrong. Yeah.
Just three, I think. The 90s were, unless I'm missing something really obvious, it was Last of the Mohicans, Heat, and The Insider.
Yeah, and The Insider came towards the end, and the Insider became the movie that I saw of his in the theater, the first one.
Okay.
It was the first one I had seen in the theater, based on my love of Manhunter. But so I watched this movie, and at the end of it, I put it back on, and I watched it again. And at the end of that second time, I got a meal, cooked a meal, and then I put it in and watched it again. So three times in a row, right out of the gate. And the reason was, there was something about it that clicked for me, because it was a movie about hunting a serial killer that was so devoid of toxic masculinity in weird ways. You know, you can talk about the sort of overt way that Will Graham's character is. You know, he is a man's man in a weird way, but not. You know, the movie just struck me in its sensitivity towards another living being, you know, like that I hadn't seen in a serial killer hunting film or any of these thrillers where they were seen as these ravenous, you know, evils. And for once, it just, you know, the killer was given a level of humanity that I hadn't seen before. And that's what really, really hit me, is that he was like, there, even though he does horrific things, Michael Mann doesn't judge him, the Francis Dollar-Eyed character. And that was really important to me as someone who wanted to make films. It started to dawn on me that the movies that I really loved the most and really, really responded to were the ones that didn't have good guys and bad guys. They had people in situations trying to figure their way through life, you know? And that to me was really, really strong. And that's what brought me into Manhunter, was that, and ever since then, you know, I obviously, after I saw Manhunter, I was like, oh, what's this double VHS Heat? And then I watched that, and it was, you know, obviously that one's more traditional in some ways, but again, a very beautiful movie, beautifully acted. And the overall idea again is, we don't judge these people. We try to look at why they become what they are and empathize with them. So it was like, for me, having, you know, Asperger's, they always say that people with Asperger's don't have empathy. This was the sort of old way of thinking about people with autism. Mm-hmm. But I had known from a very early age that I had an overload of empathy. And so I retreat from things when I see them sort of take over. And that's why I was talking about toxic masculinity, is that I have a very, you know, like, I'm somebody who cries over pretty much anything. And it's just not something that people want in that sort of environment. And it really bugged me and it bummed me out. And, you know, and in Michael Mann's film, it felt like he had made being empathetic cool. And that's what I responded to in Manhunter.
That's really, that is an interpretation of it that I hadn't heard before, but I get it. I get it. It makes a great deal of sense. Have you read the book? Did you ever read Red Dragon?
I started to get into it. And what often happens is you start reading and it's not the same.
Yeah.
And so I stopped reading it because it wasn't, all the moments were there, but it wasn't the Will Graham that Michael Mann wanted to see and that I had, you know, become interested in. And, yeah, you know, I love Silence of the Lambs, but there, again, Lecter's a monster in a dungeon. It's a different vibe, you know, it's a totally different vibe. And there are two different movies, there are two different stories, and the focus is on Jodie Foster in that one. And the sort of the hard arc for her to sort of get to her place of where she needs to be. And it's not so much about those, but the killer and Lecter being human beings, you know?
Yeah. The reason I asked about the book was that Thomas Harris does something with Dollarhyde that is completely different from what the movie does, but it informs the movie in a really interesting way. He spends a lot of time on Dollarhyde's childhood. That he was born with a cleft palate, that he was kind of passed around foster homes. Like, it's in two lines of dialogue in the film, but by dwelling on it and offering some truly traumatic moments from his young life and showing us how he was shaped into the man who wants to be the Tooth Fairy and who's obsessed with the painting and with becoming, he gives man everything he needs to do it without words. And watching the film, I mean, I first saw it in 86, I guess, when it came out, and I was really, I'm old enough to have seen it in the theater, and it was impressive, but it was also very much in line with 80s cinema in a way that worked against it at the time, because you're primed to almost dismiss it for how slick it is and for the way it uses music and the way man's obsessions are already carving themselves out. Plus, I had seen The Keep beforehand, and The Keep is like, there's just
it's on my list of remakes to do, because there's so much there, and there's so much meat there to bring back. But yeah, it wasn't.
And I was carrying over all the neon and the synth and things from The Keep and thinking, oh, he's doing that again. And what I didn't realize at the time, because he had to make three or four movies before I could fully understand it, is that is all he does. And he applies it to whatever subject he's approaching in an interesting way. So yes. It's in a really strange way, the other filmmaker I would compare him to is Woody Allen, because Woody Allen can only work in one drive, in one mode. All of his films look and sound the same, no matter when they're taking place or when they're set. And, you know, obviously there are a million reasons not to want to talk about Woody Allen right now, but
yeah.
Michael Mann, I think, has transcended that limitation in a way that Allen never did.
Well, and unfortunately, I've been talking with people about the film Come True lately, and you know, people are saying, well, you've got this dreamlike feel, and was that intentional? And while it was very intentional, I also realized that if you look at my original cut of my previous film and Father's Day on In Holidays, unfortunately, I think I'm with Mann there. And I'm probably the same way, is that all of my films will feel the same way, and that, and the thing that I'm tackling will be dealt with in a similar manner. Mm-hmm. Because I think for me, you know, whether it's Thief, Manhunter, or Heat, those three films all equal for me an emotional feeling at the end of the movie that is meant to leave you in a place. Like, he takes you to that end scene in every movie. So I don't know. The best way to describe it is you don't know that you're heading to that end. And when you get there, it's for me, uber powerful. And I really can't tell you why, but I know that I'm sort of on that same journey. I know that I'm on that same journey of, I want to leave people with an emotional feeling more than them caring about the plot A, B, and C's. And yeah. I think Michael Mann is there as well.
I think what Mann does is he gives this incredible gravity, this inevitability to the things that happen in his movies, where any chance of avoiding a confrontation was abandoned a long time ago, maybe even before the movie started.
Yes.
You know, De Niro going back in Heat because Neil McCauley cannot let it go.
Yeah.
And violating everything and all his rules, of course, because anybody who spends an entire two acts of a movie explaining the one thing you must always do is obviously going to break that rule.
Yeah.
But watching it on repeat versions, I'm trying to figure out if he's just telling that to people because he's trying to make himself believe it, or if it's just a thing he does to sound cool or tough, because he's clearly not the confident person he projects himself to be. And that's in De Niro's performance more than it is in the script, which is amazing. Will Graham in Manhunter is someone who can only do one thing, right? Like, no matter what he does, he's going to get drawn back to this thing that, because he's the only one who can do it. And Peterson plays it with exhaustion, which I think is so interesting. Like, he's not depressed. He's not despairing. He's just so tired.
It's his duty. It's his duty. And see, that's the thing that drew me in again, is that performance is one of duty. And I do feel strongly about, if you're going to say yes to those kinds of things and you think you can help people, then you kind of have to, you know, I love the performance. I can't remember the actress who plays his wife.
Yeah, Kim Grice from Brazil, same year, basically.
She's so good. The way she is supportive of him, even though it's like she knows he has to, and she's so supportive of him in that way. It's a tender relationship, much like Ashley Judd in Val Kilmer in Heat. You know, she knows this person and how they are and loves them despite their flaws. And that really, to me, is like, I don't know, it just was not portrayed a lot in that period. And it really, really struck me hard. And it informed how I wanted my life to be. And I do have a great wife who supports me in my filmmaking endeavors that are my duty and we're drawn in and have to do because we love doing it so much. So there's a lot of silly parallels in that. Why? Because as someone with Asperger syndrome, and you know, this is in the manual for how to deal with us people, we find a lot of our rules and social cues from media, and therefore judge those interactions probably more harshly than I think, you know, other people would. And so, yeah, a lot of who I wanted to be came from watching this movie.
So how often did you return to it? Was it like a talisman almost?
Yes, 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 it is. And, you know, for better or worse, and you can see that in my own work, for better or worse, I can't escape it. I can't escape its framing. I can't escape its themes. I can't escape its emotionality. Yeah.
Interesting.
It's really, really, really influential. And I have 6 copies of the poster, and like, I'm someone who just, even though the poster, you know, art is quite funny, that typeface, next level, like, I'm sure when you're younger, you're like, what is this movie? Manhunter in this bubble font. It makes almost no sense. But yeah, I can't shed it. And it really comes down to, for a piece of pop art to have that much humanity, there's something to be said for that, you know, and I really, really respect it. And I wish there were more cool guy action movies where there was that much humanity. And I think that's the special thing about it, is that it's this surface cool, you know, super cool cop going to kill a serial killer, but it has so much humanity in the way that everyone interacts with each other. There's love, and there's, you know, you're probably right. A lot of it comes from the text, but the fact is it's there. It affected Michael Mann, and it stayed for Heat, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It stuck around for The Insider as well.
Yeah. The way he translates exposition into glances and feeling is really surprising to me, even now, because I don't know how he does that. I don't know how you read a chapter about the young Dollarhide and you compress it into Will Graham listening to those tiny flecks of exposition that fly by over the course of the movie as he pieces this man's identity
together. Or a look
together.
By Tom Noonan playing Francis Dollarhide. Like he haunted human being, a haunted human being. That's the best way you can describe it. And that's not what we were used to, you know, from serial killers. They're not haunted human beings. They're beasts to be hunted and murdered and brought down.
Yeah. The moment with the scenes Noonan has, and I didn't want to not talk about Noonan because it's a phenomenal performance, but the scenes he has with Stephen Lang, as Freddie Lowndes, who is, just the biggest cartoon in a film where everyone could have been one. He like Lang just goes for it. And it's clearly an actor having a blast being the supporting role of the film. Just the sense that Lang is trying to be the biggest personality. And then Noonan understands that all he has to do is underplay against him. And we get Dollarhide, because it suddenly turns into Dollarhide giving a performance of himself, which is so unnerving.
And it even breaks Lang's performance.
Yeah.
All of a sudden that person drops that persona and they are the real person. And then, oh, now you're dead.
Yeah. Sniveling, terrified actor.
Yes.
But there's an audio book of Red Dragon read by Chris Sarandon, which I came to years and years later. It works, but the thing about it is he overplays the Tooth Fairy. He kind of goes back to Jerry Dandridge in Fright Night, and the Do You See sequence is
I'd love to hear that. Yeah,
so big, and it's fun to listen to, but the way Noonan handles it is actually so much more unnerving.
Yeah, do you see?
He's thought about it, and it's methodical, and he's not really interested in the answer, which I think is the best part.
Yes, he has no interest in the answer. Yeah, it's weird. Yeah, it's great. Love it.
Yeah, and just the fact that it doesn't give us... Structurally, it's impossible because of all of Thomas Harris's books. Like, there are 2 parallel lines that eventually meet. You know, there's no diner scene, like in Heat. There's no moment where Graham and Dollarhide just sort of bump into each other in a hospital. They come close.
Between Graham and the window. I don't know. that's the diner scene. He's like, he touches the window and he knows he's touching that man. It's so, that stuff is, you know, so fun so cheesy. It's good. Like, I just love it. And I love the gall of the composer to completely rip off Pink Floyd.
Yeah. I just,
like, come on.
It's so a direct example or something, but no, it's not.
It is. That if you listen to the behind the scenes on the, I think the Shout Blu-ray, mm-hmm. talks about how he sort of came up with that. And it's like, by listening to Pink Floyd and taking the notes and then putting them in the same progressions. I love it.
That's just how people do things now. Yeah. I mean, he predicted it 40 years ago.
It is how people 35. Do things now.
And part of that is the 80s synth production, right? Where anything goes because you're just expecting like a Flock of Seagulls song to burst out at any moment. There is definitely a music video sensibility to Manhunter, but I don't think it's a negative, right? I mean, definitely dismissed it that way at the time. And it wasn't until I think.
Well, you've seen Come True.
Yes, sure.
I don't shy away from that either, because I think there is a value to that as a art form that brings about a sincere emotionality.
Yeah, when it works, when it's conscious and when it's applied by someone who knows what they're doing. Because at the time, everyone was doing it, right? That's what I mean. You became immune to it because you were seeing it in 20 music videos a day and every trailer or TV spot was cut the same way and they were all just...
But you knew when it worked. It was like Friedkin's counterfeiting montage. It's like in To Live and Die in LA, like you just knew when it worked. It just felt like real. There's like a difference, right? It's like they're putting it on for music video's sake, and then there's the emotional reason to do it, or the weird feeling you get from it. I guess that's what I was saying about Asperger's, is that when I'm watching this stuff, when something's real, it hits me. Mm-hmm. When I can tell that the filmmaker is talking real talk and trying to really get me to feel something, it hits you differently. And that was what this movie did for me.
Yeah. You're connecting to the intention.
Yes. Yeah. I often say I'm not watching movies. I'm having a dialogue with whoever made the film. That's how it feels to me when I'm watching a film. And so, you know, even when we were watching I Care a Lot the other day, and about 15 minutes in, I said, I don't know that this is going to go the way that everyone wants it to go in the room. And everyone's like, what are you talking about? I said, well, I can tell by what's happening where this is going to go. And they were like, what are you talking about? I said, it's not going where you want it to. And I was right. And it's because the intent is all the shot choices and what they choose to make feel cool versus not. You know, these are things that it's like I could tell that Michael Mann didn't have an ill intent towards his characters. He really was empathetic to this whole scenario. You know, that's which I guess doesn't matter to some people, but it matters to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, the experience of watching I Care a Lot was just gleeful because I could tell right away that Jay Blakeson is treating these people as caricatures. Like there were no virtuous people at all. So that was easy.
No, but what was weird is that I felt through certain choices. Mm. I call it the Jedi mind trick.
Okay.
The Jedi mind trick can work. And if you start to make something fun enough, people can forget that they did something really unsavory.
And okay. So it doesn't, characters don't have to be redeemable if they're entertaining. If yes. The story is told in
another great example is, and it's just, it's a Jedi mind trick of this is so much fun. I'm there. Right. And the people I was watching with were like, oh, I can't wait till she chose the wrong person this time. I said, he's not going to go there. They're not going to all of a sudden get retribution on her because he's already shown her too many times as a human being. And once they, you know, because she wasn't a villain. Like, well, she is. She's absolutely a villain. And exactly. I think everyone watching with us was sort of expecting the opposite, that the mob would come in or Diane Weiss would be, you know, our sort of like comeuppance, you know.
Right.
And she was not.
No, it's not that kind of movie.
Yeah, yeah. And that's and here's my other example is Star Trek II, was it Into Darkness? Is that the one?
Oh yeah. The new one, Star Trek Into Darkness.
Where I'm muddy on the details, but I just remember watching that one with people and everyone missed the fact that Kirk had decided to sacrifice, I think, millions of lives for the crew of the Enterprise. Like there's like a crashing moment where it's like he chooses the crew of the Enterprise over millions of people and Captain Kirk that I grew up with would have never done that. And so it's the Jedi mind trick of if the thing is entertaining enough, you forget the laws of morals. And what I mean by the laws of morals is that you yourself, get lost in the excitement. And it might not be what you actually believe yourself, but all of a sudden you get be tricked into a totally different moral standpoint.
Sure.
I mean, it's fun for me to watch.
Yeah, certainly the thing that man does in movies like Heat is it makes the bad guys as, well, there are no bad guys. There are. Okay, wait, hang on. Wingro's a bad guy. What man does in a movie
Wingro
like Heat.
Wingro is a bad guy.
Yeah,
Wingro is a bad guy.
Bad guy who shows us that McCauley and his crew aren't the bad guys.
Yes.
Right? Like he creates the sliding scale of morality, but he also, even as far back as Thief, is focusing on an individual who does a thing very well, and then the legality of it and the morality of it is almost irrelevant to the film.
Yeah.
He's our point of view. He's the character that we're following. What we get in Manhunter is there is absolutely no hint that Dolarhyde is doing anything the film approves of, right? That we see the carnage, yes. We see the destruction, we fear him when he shows up in someone's home. But yeah, as soon as he satisfies that compulsion, he goes back to being a decent member of society, basically. It's just
a guy who's developing film.
Yeah. And courting a nice woman and taking her to see a tiger, which is still a scene that, I mean, when it shows up, I think it shows up in Brett Ratner's Red Dragon, and it's just Brett Ratner showing us the kitty. It's not anything like what the man scene is about.
The man and scene is about there's
connection,
a human,
right? Like
he's trying to connect to another person, and it's so hard for him. And again, someone with Asperger's, I watch that scene and I go, this is my dilemma. As I don't speak, especially as a teenager, I'm not speaking the same way other people are speaking, and I'm not focused on the same things that other people are focused on. And it really was, again, you know, like this idea, because when you don't know you have something like that, you feel like you're a bad person because you're not getting it. And that really, really affected me, because it is about them connecting, and they're two outsiders, you know, they're two outsiders who are finding each other, and you feel the horror because you know that's not going to work. You know it's not going to work because he has this desire. So,
yeah, and you know, Joan Allen
to feel bad for a killer, you know, is a weird predicament for anyone watching a movie. You know,
someone described it as a werewolf movie once, and I kind of get that.
Really?
Well, the Dolarhyde's obsession with the moon and his ability to put it all aside and just turn it off effectively until the compulsion returns to him, which is apparently how a serial killer's psychology works. There are long stretches where the compulsion is manageable.
Dormant, yeah.
Yeah, although, of course, the werewolf thing is a metaphor purely. I'm not trying to suggest that he is. He even has to put in bitey teeth, right, to be the monster. But he transforms physically and chooses to do so. And it's such an interesting argument, because if it is a werewolf movie, I mean, if it's about a split in personality and a complete division, then Dolarhyde wouldn't be selecting his victims that way, right? Like it works. The metaphor stretches right up until it snaps, because his job is what allows him to choose people. And that's horrifying. That incredible note that drops when they figure it out is just so satisfying, because it's there. It's right in front of us the whole time. We simply don't notice it because it's not important. And the way
where did we get this footage? Where did we get this footage? Yeah. In the first place. It's so good. Yeah.
Yeah. And the way man structures it is wonderful. And then of course there's the real monster, right? We haven't even got to Lector.
I know, we haven't even Lector. Yeah. Such a bizarre spelling for, I don't quite know the reason.
Don't know either. It felt like a weird typo when I saw it, because all the other names are kept.
Well, it is the time of that sort of like, who, what's his name? Lector? Okay.
Yeah. Just the idea that there was ever a point in time where no one knew who Hannibal Lecter was.
I know.
And Brian Cox is just so pleasurable. I think until Mickelson came along, he was my favorite Lecter. Full props to Anthony Hopkins. He makes it fun. But there's this great slowness to Cox. The sense that, like, the way his mouth hangs open, the way he watches people, that just doesn't feel 100% human. And makes you realize after a while, like on repeated viewings, I finally realized his problem, his thing is that he's mad he got caught.
Oh, yeah.
He's just playing the resentment of that. And I'd never seen that before in any performance like this, any villain performance.
Yeah.
And it's just so good.
And then he's going to, I'll get you. I will get you. Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's funny. It's once you know what you know in Silence of the Lambs, you think, oh, what would that Lecter have done had he gotten out or had he had the chance, you know, like to see him eat somebody would be the scariest of all of them, I think.
Yeah. I think he would have just disappeared completely. He wouldn't be showy the way Hopkins is at the end, walking around like it looks like he's murdered Klaus Kinski and taken his hat and his hair. He would just disappear completely. And then one day you'd come home and he'd be in your house. And like, that's it. That would be it.
Yeah, he's the hyper-intelligent version, for sure.
Yeah, patient.
He's not theatrical. And yeah, the difference of Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, it's inhuman, you know, but it is scary. It's fun. Like I said, Jodie Foster's the human in that film.
Well, Hopkins Lecter does what he does to draw you closer because he's charming in that way. He's trying to seduce people and getting close, and Cox is just waiting for you to make a mistake or to turn your head the wrong way. Yeah. And the fact too, that this Lecter, as opposed to the Lecter in Harris's books, as he started getting more and more, you know, like baroque in the novels, even before they did it in the movies, Lecter outsources the murder in this, like he just gives someone Graham's home address.
The info. Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't even need to do it himself. Like it's not a point of pride with him.
No, it's just playing with people, which if you know, watch enough documentaries on this, sometimes the game is interesting enough for serial killers. And that's the scariest, like we're playthings. And I think that's the scary part of his Lecter, is that you know that everyone in the movie is a plaything for him at some point.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you hadn't read the book, this would have been, or had you? Yeah, because you're younger and you came to it later. Had you seen The Silence of the Lambs beforehand?
Yes, beforehand.
Oh, okay.
And so when I saw this, I was like, wait. And it's always fun to get, you know, alternate universe afterwards, you know, instead of it being the first introduction to the character.
Yeah.
It's like going back and finding old Marvel movies. Or starting there and then getting the new ones and then telling people about the old Marvel movies. But that alternate universe of, wait, there's a whole other interpretation of this character that we know and love so well. It was bizarre. It was bizarre to see that. And for it to be so clean and sterile as opposed to, and honestly more realistic, but not the layout of that place at the end when he's running around and exiting because he has a panic attack. It's classic Michael Mann. And, you know, I think that's the other thing I responded to it. And I've been talking a lot about this lately, is that I think my favorite directors and the films I really come back to don't take place in reality at all. They take place in an alternate reality that is their own, whether it's David Lynch, Michael Mann, Brian De Palma. You know, I find myself returning to movies where it's an alternate universe. Even slasher films, you know, I talk sometimes about like horror movies and slashers. I'm not a huge slasher fan, but the ones I do return to take place in an alternate universe where reality is not as it is here. And so while the themes are really important and they tend to tell the story, you know, clearly the world itself is not, like there is no world like Michael Mann's world. Like that, and that really excites me because you still take everything at face value and you follow the story, but you take for granted that these places don't exist at all. No one act like, I can't imagine an FBI investigator acting and reacting and taking on this horrible task with the sort of coolness that William, you know, Peterson does. And yet we accept it. And me personally, I'm highly affected by it, but these are not realities, you know. And it's funny because Michael Mann prides himself so much on his search for authenticity, and in doing so has created a multiverse of, like, if you think of Black Hat as a realistic environment, like, no.
I was going to say. Black yeah, like Public Enemies, Automatic, and Miami Vice yeah. all just sort of contradict that thesis.
Oh, but he does so much research and has the actors do so much stuff. But then again, he has them do all this stuff and then puts on a crazy mustache and jacket, you know, like that breaks it all. And I love that. It's his version of this. And that, you know, no matter who's directing a film, I love to see their version of events, not the real version. And that's really what, you know, I'm saying I'm drawn to.
Yeah. Even as you're describing like Peterson's Will Graham, it's like, it's true. No one this haunted and obsessive would take that much time putting gel in his hair every day.
Exactly. Those are the details. And that's the stuff that, that I guess makes me smile and enjoy the film, you know, that those are the construct of making the film and the auteur vision there, it turns it into something different. Because let's face it, if it was completely real, it would probably, we wouldn't want to watch it, you know?
Yeah, it would either be repulsive.
Or it would be repulsive.
Flat, right, depending on which character you were following.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about this too, because the only way to get away from man's construction was to take it in another when Brian Fuller mounted Hannibal, and really was telling Will Graham's story as much as Hannibal Lecter's. The only way he could get away from it was to be completely stylized in a different direction.
Yeah,
and that, I mean, I avoided that show until maybe somewhere into its middle of its second season, just because I couldn't believe it could possibly work. And what it is just so satisfying.
I know. I know. It's well, and you know, I struggle with it because I am weirdly, because of my Asperger's, bound by morals.
Okay.
And that's why, you know, I care a lot. I struggled with because I knew where they were going. I knew they were, from the shot choices and how they were, I was like, they're going to try and make us like this character. And I cannot get behind someone doing this. I want her dead. I want her dead from seriously, 5 minutes in, I wanted her dead. Like, go away, please stop being so horrifically evil. And so I almost can't watch those movies play out because I'm bound by this weird moral compass. And it's part of my personal exploration into media is when I'm writing a screenplay, I purposefully will write in characters that challenge us as a society to make a judgment on their own, but to really put into people's faces what we've accepted up till this point as normal behavior, whether it's stalking someone or, you know, like using your position of power to subtly shift someone into liking you, whatever that is, you know, it's part of what I like to do to sort of challenge people's notions in that way, because I think entertainment does. I'm one of these people. I don't believe in censorship, but I definitely think that media affects people because I've been affected by it. I've look. I told you the story. I wanted to be the Manhunter of filmmaking. So
right. Well, as long as you don't want to be the Dollarhide of filmmaking, that's fine.
Exactly. I want to be the Will Graham of filmmaker making, make it my duty, no matter how small the budget, to try and do the best version of a movie I can.
That's aspirational. That's fine. I'm entirely okay with that.
But it's weird for a filmmaker to be moralistic in the way that I am. And I recognize that fully.
But again, that's what makes something distinct, right? It's somehow, it's how we know it's your movie.
Yes.
And what does strike me about Come True is how, I'm trying to figure out how to talk about it without spoiling it for people. But the thing that I really found got under my skin was the sense that we are allowed to know when people are making poor choices. Like, the movie understands when people are doing something that is self-destructive or just, you know, like, as you mentioned, professionally endangering things. Yeah. There's a relationship between someone who should know better and someone who absolutely should know better. And the movie knows that balance of power is there, or that imbalance of power is there, as opposed to a film that tries.
But I don't judge it. It's for you to judge. And that's the thing. Yeah.
But the dynamic is very obvious, right? Like, you're not
so obvious. And that's, No, not at all. And, you know, it's funny when people come head to head with certain aspects like that and think like, wait, did he just lose his marbles? No. Yeah. Funny yeah. stuff.
No, yeah. I love it when I can trust a movie. The most thrilling thing is to watch a film stick the landing like that and go somewhere that, as man does, like it was the only place it could have gone, but it kept me on the back foot as to what that was going to be.
Yeah. Listen, I can't hide my influence of this film. If you see Come True and then you see Manhunter, you will see that they're swimming together in, but I'm the B version. You know, I like to tell people, like, my movies are B movies, but like I'm trying to make them at a different sort of, you know, intersection.
Yeah. So. I mean, there are plenty of B movies that are remembered forever for what they do. It's just a question of how you execute it and what it is that you want to say. I think, I mean, Manhunter's a yeah. B movie. It was released by an independent studio and an adaptation of a book that was well-regarded, but still sort of received as pulp. It always surprised me that Silence of the Lambs is the one that got everyone to take things seriously when Demme is just making the best version of a thriller that he knows how to make. It's not to say anything.
Well, it's layered movie, though, but, you know, it's layered. And I think that's the thing that really, really, if, you know, in all reality, it is the better movie. Silence of the Lambs to me is the better movie. Did it hit me as hard? No, but to me, it's the better movie because of how it tackles the character of Clarice. You know, it is a super, super, it's a powerhouse of filmmaking to me, like personally, like, you know, for entertainment, you know, like sure. There's different levels of what, but for me, you know, like what do I connect with more? Manhunter, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean any disrespect to the Silence of the Lambs. I think they're both, Manhunter and Silence are sort of in a duet with one another in terms of how you adapt this material and what you do with it. They are radically different. And I think it's smart that, you know, no one tried to carry over any of the characters that the same, like Dennis Farina doesn't return. They got Scott Glenn instead. That's all fine. That, you know, you can make these things separate.
Can you imagine Dennis Farina in Silence of the Lambs in that same role? It would be amazing.
I think he would have been great. Amazing.
He's trying to hit on Clarice. Like,
oh yeah.
Everyone would have been like, that's never happening.
Yeah. I think he would though. And I think Demme would have gotten a great performance out of him because it was Demme.
Yes.
I think he would have made it interesting. But Scott Glenn also just gives you this sense of someone who's, like, he's filling in for Will Graham. He's exhausted and tired, and he's lived with this too long now. And there's a throwaway mention. I don't think it's in the, Will Graham doesn't come up in Silence at all. They don't mention him by name, but in the book, there's a little reference to him as just a ruined drunk whose life has been destroyed by the fallout from Dollar Hyde.
What a bummer.
Yeah.
What a bummer. Yeah.
Because William Peterson's not going to go there. He's
exactly. You imagine
cool when the movie starts.
He goes back to his family and sort of says, you know what? I'll never do this again until he has to, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. The tragedy of Manhunter isn't that he finishes. It's he finishes Dollar Hyde, but his work isn't over.
Yeah.
Poor guy.
Haunted dude. Yeah. I don't know what else we could say about Manhunter other than, you know, it's something that if you hadn't seen it, you should probably check it out because it definitely a cool movie.
Yeah.
It's not for everybody.
I'm fascinated now in the retroactive aspect of it, of coming to this after you've seen, you know, the second half of the third season of Hannibal, where this story was told in a very, very different way. I think it was the second half.
I don't even think they're the same two. That I have this weird thing with Hannibal where I have this feeling that they're a totally different universe, you know, I don't even count them as the same story. They're just totally, you know, it's just another, yeah, it's weird. I love it because it gives us this ability to, revisit the themes. Like when you're thinking about remakes, reboots and things, this is what I would wish for all remakes and reboots is have respect for the original stuff, but go do your own thing. You know, don't try and remake something the way it was or play exactly to what, you know, you think the strengths of the original were. Like it's probably the best example of taking source material and making it one's own and for the best.
Yeah, it's you're right. They're not even speaking the same language, really.
No, it's a totally, themes are all different. And I love that. And I think, you know, as long as you got the core idea that people can hang their hat on and really enjoy. That's why whenever anyone says like, oh, the remake, that I'm like, let them try, you know, let's like these, there are things that we like about this. Let's try a remake and reboot. It's just often it doesn't, it's not coming from a passionate place. And with Hannibal, you could tell it was coming from a passionate place. So.
Yeah. So many times the takeaway from these things is that I didn't need to be there. Like it just, you know, it was, mm-hmm. it was done as an IP exercise and the studio got the deal they wanted and everybody's happy, but you don't need me. And watching everyone refilter and reinterpret Harris has been really interesting. I mean, the Brett Ratner remake doesn't work. It's just flat. And Manhunter is a better version of that on every level. And it's weird that they keep the same structure and do the same things when they could have done what
and even
Fuller did.
Even weirder is they share the same DLP.
That's right.
Dante Spinotti shot both of those. Never in a million years, no. And isn't that wild?
I forgot about that.
I found that connection just bizarre.
Oh, I would love to talk to him about that someday.
I know. But they never worked together again. And they had worked, that was a long standing collaboration. So I don't know if something happened. People make that movie. I'm done with you, man.
I just assume it's because Spinotti didn't want to switch over to like the handheld stuff, the digital GoCams that Mann is becoming obsessed with. Cause that, like, that's something Michael Mann is so good at shooting celluloid that it breaks my heart to see what he's chosen to do. And you know, it's his choice. He wants to do this. I can't fault him for having the power to make these decisions and doing what he wants to do, but it's just not cinematic to me.
No, it's perplexing. That's the best way you can say, is that for someone who understands imagery and it's so much a part of their art, you know, he comes from he has a huge appreciation for fine art, and to then make those films the way they look, it's you know, listen, I don't want to disparage Michael Mann, he's an amazing filmmaker, but at the same time someone needs to bring film back to his universe.
Yeah,
maybe it's the cost, you know, maybe it's the cost, maybe it's the takes, you know,
it's true he is famous for that.
Yeah, so I mean, and you know, it's a different world, people aren't giving as much money as they used to make movies. I can say that with confidence. and so maybe that's part of the equation. He gets to do what he wants, and only if he does it on these cameras. Yeah. So and I just hope someone comes along that can shoot more in a filmic style for him.
Yeah. It feels to me like he's in love with the fluidity of digital video, of a certain type of it. And yet I can't stand it when he does it. Come True has
those
fluid dreamlike movements that don't push me away in the way that Mann's choice.
Well, they're 24 frames per second. That's why.
Yeah, that's probably it, isn't
That's a huge one. No, it's 60 frames per second when you start, you get into the True Vision sort of realm. And what True Vision does is it breaks the simulation.
Yep.
It breaks the simulation. And all of a sudden, an amazing film actor is someone doing a stage play. And it really breaks that. And so if you're used to doing a certain kind of acting, I remember the first time it happened, they shot X-Files. They did one episode in video. It was like a cops episode.
Oh, right. Yeah, the cops
episode.
It was
a cops episode. And it was shot in 30 frames or 60 frames, probably 30 frames at the time.
Yeah.
I just remember thinking, whoa, all of a sudden David Duchovny can't act. And it was
just the contrast.
The contrast of someone acting like they were in a TV show when being videotaped, because our brains are wired. That's real. And so it better be real. It's this falsehood that I'm talking about with like the movies we've come to love take place in a universe that doesn't exist.
Right.
And the minute you put videotape on it, all of a sudden, oh, it really shows that it's fake and the facade is broken.
I mean, I actually wrote that in my Public Enemies review at the time. It looked like kids playing dress up. just because I have this.
Pow, even the sound, how he would not do Hollywood fully for the guns. And it sounded like, you know, it's like, whoa, it sounds like playing guns.
Yeah. And the muzzle flash is registering as like those bursts of white on video, because that's how it looked at the time.
It would look. Yeah. And the,
It turns out I have this visceral reaction to period films being shot handheld. I didn't know that about myself until a few years back, but it's like, no, they didn't have those cameras then. Stop it.
Yes.
They didn't have any cameras then.
Because you're thinking about all the stuff. Yeah. Together. Yeah.
Yeah.
Production designers talk about that sometimes, Norm, when we're on set, is the idea that you don't want to see something in the frame and have the film be not running on the same energy as the thing in the frame.
So
your film itself needs to be running on a similar energy. And it's why when we see something like The Witch and it's a lock off, it makes so much sense to us, because if they had some drone shot going through there, all of a sudden your brain breaks, because that's not that time.
Even in stuff like Black Hat, which is supposed to be contemporary, it just doesn't really land.
But again, you know, we're talking about the aesthetics and the universe that is Michael Mann.
Oh yeah, no, it's what he wants to do, no question.
Is that you have these characters who are supposed to be, you know, like the world's best hacker, who has perfect hair and is muscular as heck. Like, it's just everything is a broken reality, and I think the video camera just accentuates that. And that's why if this all was in film where it was made in 1998, it might all work for us.
Yeah. You know? Oh, I'm
and
sure.
It's really about understanding the audience's willingness. You know, I just wrote something about the dreams for Come True, and we chose the sort of camera movement based on the idea that in the dreams that, you know, because people play so many video games now, one of the main ways that we enter new worlds is first person and third person shooters. This is how we enter new and experimental worlds. And so the best way for the camera to move in that world, not only based on my own dreams, because I actually tend to float in my dreams this way, but it just made sense that this was the way that people would accept. And that's part of being a filmmaker, is understanding it. When I'm delivering my message, am I delivering it in the best way so the audience can enjoy it? That is, for me, a very important part of the equation. That I mean, it's something that you should consider, because you want people to watch your film, you know? So if they can't connect with the material, and have you had some weird shaky cam or something, like, it wouldn't have worked the same way. And so.
Yeah, you're just running interference for yourself if you're not careful.
Please, Michael Mann. Back to film. Disrespect for one of my favorite filmmakers.
No, you're coming from a place of love. I totally get it.
I am coming from, I'm trying to save him.
My thanks to Anthony Scott Burns, whose disturbing new thriller, Come True, is now available on VOD platforms across North America. Watch it with all the lights off and your phone in another room. Thanks also to Ingrid Hamilton. She knows what she did. You can find Anthony on Twitter at RealPilotPriest, all one word, RealPilotPriest. And if you're lucky, you can still find that Scream Factory Blu-ray of Manhunter out there. There's an MGM edition as well, but it's just a bare-bones release of the theatrical cut. The movie's also available on Apple TV and streaming in Canada on Hollywood Suite On Demand. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com, where I'm hosting a bunch of podcasts these days and writing a weekly now-streaming newsletter, to which you can subscribe at nowtoronto.substack.com. And you can find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. Every little bit helps, it truly does. I mean, if you want to wish us a happy anniversary this week, that would be very nice. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network while you're there. I'm really liking Tara Jean Stevens' Heaven Bent about the Toronto Blessing Church and some stuff that happened around it. Stay inside, watch movies, wear a mask if you go out, and really, thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.